Morning, everybody. You see the title of the sermon? I promise, this title was decided upon like weeks and weeks and weeks ago, like way before the Patriots decided to cheat. Again, way before. I hadn't intended on using any Super Bowl references today, but here it is. We got it out of the way. That's it. We're done. They cheated. It's okay. We forgive. Allegedly. That's it. It's funny. It's strange. It's interesting that cheating is so prevalent in our media and what's being talked about in society right now. There's different definitions. It doesn't necessarily mean intentionally deceiving someone or something or a system for gain or cutting corners or fast-tracking. You can even think about cheating like you're taking, and incrementally, you're taking energy and resources from one area of life and pouring it into another area of life. Usually, we think about people who are very, very active business people, and they stay just a little later and a little later and work a little harder, and they sort of cheat their families or important people or even themselves and their hopes and dreams and long-term goals. They take from this pool and they pour into this pool, and eventually they're sucked dry. So cheating is broad, so we're not going to narrow anything down. It's going to cover a lot of surface this morning. I want to tell one of my own cheating stories. I was a cheater from youth. This one hurt. It really hurt because of how far this went. I was in fourth grade, and our school had a competition. We were invited to compete for an anti-smoking ad campaign. And these people came to us and said, have all your students draw the best anti-smoking picture or poster that they can, and we'll judge. And if it's good enough, someone will go to regionals, and then this thing will get published. And in grammar school, you know, you judge your worth and your merit, at least in my school, based on like two or three things. How fast can you run? How good could you draw? I wasn't that fast. I was terrible at drawing. Oh, man, this wasn't my competition. So I go home, and I got into crisis mode because I didn't want to do it. I was scared. I'm going to get laughed at. And eventually, my mom comes to me and says, hey, your cousin is a great drawer. He's very artistic. You're not artistic at all. He's very artistic. Just ask him to do it. Who cares? No big deal. Oh, awesome. I am off the hook. My mom told me I could do this. It's definitely going to be okay. So my cousin draws this awesome, awesome picture. I wish I had it and kept it to this day. It was a Joker holding a deck of cards, and the cards were on fire, and they were lit by the cigarette, and it had this really catchy phrase, if you play these cards, you're going to get burned, or something like scary. No one would ever want to smoke after seeing that thing. And so I come with this to school, and my teachers are like, oh, Sean, amazing. We never knew you had this talent. Yeah, me neither. But my friends are looking at me like, dude, that's not you. Don't worry about it. The actual worst part of it all was my friends who could draw and did take this assignment seriously. They got burned, especially so because my drawing won. It won in my class, and then it won in my school, and then I got invited to like the district conference competition. I got to miss school for a day, go to some ballroom, sit in on a lecture with all these anti-smoking advocates and business people and healthcare educators, and have a brunch and miss school, and everyone else had to be at school. And if I won there, I was gonna go to like nationals. So now this thing has gone on for months, and I'm churning. Oh, this is so bad. This is so bad. This is so cool, but this is so bad. And the catch 22 was my family was like, Sean, go for it. Like, this is great. And my teachers were like, Sean, you're representing our school. Go for it. This is so great. But my friends are like, you're a jerk. Like, this is my opportunity. So I'm churning. Who do I please? My parents, my school, my friends kind of hate me right now. I just don't feel good about this. So I'm praying to the degree I knew how to pray in fourth grade. Please don't let me win. Please don't let me win. And thankfully, I didn't win. So I kind of lurked back to school the next day. Oh, guys, I didn't win. It's over. And I got like the side eye from my friends for a couple months. And it just wasn't a feel-good story. Particularly, it wasn't a feel-good story because of who was encouraging me to keep going forward and blessed it. This is a good and great thing. Keep going. So I took away this scar, a wound, a hardness of, I don't like that I did that. I don't like who I am. That's not the person I'm trying to be. So this is going to be a talk about not cheating and why not to cheat and how not to cheat and how to get out of it. The fact is we've cheated someone or something or ourselves in our lives, and now we bear a scar. Something has carried over. Something has gone over the edge, and we deal with it. So when choosing to cheat makes sense, it makes sense in a moment. Now it's how do you deal with the after effects. We're going to jump in to our text. It's Matthew chapter 26. And your blue pew Bible in front of you is page 962. We're going to look at the narrative of Peter and of Judas. And the narrative, we're right in the middle of the Last Supper, the moments before Jesus' eventual arrest, death, resurrection. And how do these guys walk side by side in a really hard situation when the pressure's on? In Matthew chapter 26, verse 20, when evening came, Jesus was reclining at the table with the 12. And while they were eating, he said, "Truly, I tell you, one of you will betray me." They were very sad and began to say to him, one after the other, "Surely, you don't mean me, Lord. You don't mean me, Lord." Then Judas, the one who would betray him, said, "Surely, you don't mean me, Rabbi." Jesus answered, "You have said so." So we're set up to follow Peter's journey. Now we're going to set up to follow Judas's journey. Jump to verse 30. After they finished the Last Supper, when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus told them, "This very night you will all fall away on account of me, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.' But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." Peter replied, "Even if all fall away on account of you, I never will." "Truly, I tell you," Jesus answered, "this very night, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times." But Peter declared, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." And all the other disciples said the same. Little recap, when the pressure's on and these guys know they're going to face something really heavy, Judas, "Surely you don't mean me. I won't cheat you, Lord. I won't cut corners. I'm sticking this out." Peter, "I will never, never, never will I ever. I'm not going to cheat. I'm not going to cut corners. I'm sticking with you, Lord." How's that make you feel? There's phrases we use. I'll never. Who do we say him to? God, family, friends, work. I'm not going to do that. Or I'm not going to do that anymore. Or one more time. It's just part of the human condition. We're going to follow these two characters. We'll see how Judas does when the heat is turned up. Verse 47. While he was still speaking, that's Jesus, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. With him was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. Jesus replied, "Do what you came for, friend." Then the men stepped forward, seized Jesus, and arrested him. That's Judas. See how Peter does. Now Peter, this is after Jesus' arrest, was sitting out in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him. "You also were with Jesus of Galilee," she said. "You were with him too." But he denied it before them all. "I don't know what you're talking about," he said. Then he went out to the gateway where another servant girl saw him and said to the people there, "This fellow was with Jesus of Nazareth." He denied it again with an oath. "I don't know the man." After a little while, those standing went up to Peter and said, "Surely you're one of them. Your accent gives you away." Then he began to call down curses, and he swore to them, "I don't know the man," for the third time. Remember those earlier promises, the declarations, the resolutions that they had made. "Judas, surely you don't mean me. I'm not going to be the guy. Peter, I will never disown you." Moments, minutes to hours later, these two scenes play out. They both blew it. Now here's an important observation. Notice that they don't make these decisions in a vacuum, right? It's not just them versus Jesus in this situation. They have external influences. There's people around. It's a tense situation. Judas was dealing with the chief priests, all right? Influential religious leaders that you would not want to cross. Peter was accused publicly and put on the defensive. "I saw you. You were with them." No. Right? So it's not in a vacuum. There's an accusation. There's defensiveness. "Oh, no, it's not me." The chief priest, Judas, was conspiring with them. Who knows what was going on in his soul, churning. Shouldn't I? They want me to do it. They got the power. I should probably do it. Decisions aren't made in a vacuum. There's external pressures. But then when we make the choices, we have to deal with the internal realities. We never make bad choices in a bubble, right? The effects of bad choices don't stay in the bubble. They pour out. They have consequences not just for us, but for the people all around us. In my story, as a grammar school student, my bad choices affected my friends really negatively, and in turn affected me really negatively and how I valued myself, and it formed a scar. So again, today isn't about how to reorient our lives so we never make these bad decisions. There's places and times for those. Today isn't one of those conversations. Today's about the fact that we do royally, majorly, with or without external pressures of the workplace or a family or an opportunity that we just don't want to miss. We make those bad decisions. So it's about what we do with the scars, because those bad decisions hurt. What do we do with the scars that we bear for cutting corners, for cheating ourselves, for doing less than the best for us, for our community? That's what we're going to look at. Here's how Peter responds to this wound. In verse 74 and 75, "Immediately a rooster crowed. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken. Before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times." Peter remembers. It was that night. How could he have forgotten to the point that he had to remember that he made these promises to Jesus? Well, it happened in the heat of the moment. And he went outside and he wept bitterly. He failed. He failed his master. He failed himself. And he wept. He felt it. Let's see how Judas does. Next chapter, chapter 27, verse 3. "When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. 'I have sinned,' he said, 'for I have betrayed innocent blood.' 'What is that to us?' they replied. 'That's your responsibility.'" One quick point. in various different translations of this verse, this phrase, he was seized with remorse. It's translated as he changed his mind or he repented. That is the literal meaning of these words in the original language. He repented. Judas repented. Whatever mythology and understanding and background we have about Judas in our minds, Judas repented. He felt it, and he wanted to make it right. Let that reorient your perspective on Judas for a second. There's no reason to think, there's no evidence in the text that this was a move for Judas to regain credibility or to save face or to get back in people's good graces. No, he felt it, and he repented, and he turned, and he did the first thing that came to mind is, oh, let me at least go get rid of this money. So he tries, and he does what he thinks is best. But in verse 5, we see what happens. Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and hanged himself. That's heavy. That's what makes this Judas narrative so tragic. He wanted to do the right thing. He did the quickest thing he knew how to do. He made the right move up front, but for some reason he couldn't hold on to hope. And he made an abrupt, rash decision. I'll be honest, this one hurts, and it hurts me personally because this is a story that I have. Our actions don't stay in the bubble, right? So suicide's close to me in my life, and it's affected my journey of faith. When I was a young child, my father took his life, and certainly I felt cheated for most of my life out of a dad. And it's not something I really came to grips with or grieved until my adult life. So I felt cheated. My family felt cheated. I feel like my future is cheated. First and foremost, despite his faults and flaws, which were many, I think my dad cheated himself. And I think Judas cheated himself first out of the life he could have had if he had the resources to hold out for hope. So, those are the two immediate responses. They screwed up. They felt it. Peter wept. Judas repented. But Judas repented, and then he escaped. Not quite sure what the difference was. Scripture's silent now. We move on. Just so you don't feel like you're being singled out or I'm driving you to understand consequences, right? Escape, in this sense, could mean much more than taking your life. Escape can mean just burying the junk, burying the scars and the shame. Or it can mean resolving never to talk about it. I don't want to bring that up. I don't want people to know that stuff about me. You escape, you turn to self-medication, addiction. This takes many forms, has many functions. It's escape. We don't know why Judas made such a tragic, abrupt decision. We don't know why Peter held on for just a little bit longer while feeling how bad this was. So I'm going to try to fill in the gaps with something of a modern parable you might be familiar with. It's a little lighthearted for what has just been described, but let me say this. Does anybody watch the show Mad Men? Anyone know Mad Men? I need to raise hands. Okay, it's a grown-up show. It's okay. It's a grown-up show. You can admit it. But not you. Mad Men, the story of Don Draper, right? Don Draper in the 1960s is like the epitome of cool. He's the creative director of a famous ad agency on Madison Avenue, and he's super cool, and he makes smoking look really awesome, and it's not. And it's just, it's the life. Smoking and drinking and women, and He's the creative director, and everybody knows his name, and Don Draper's living the life. He's the epitome of cool in the mid-60s. The story of Mad Men, though, is really the story of Don Draper trying to tell his story, trying to become fully known and fully loved. Not until a few episodes in. By the way, they're in their last season, so I'm not going to feel bad about spoilers. I'm telling a season 1-3 story. So we learn about Don that he was in the Korean War, and he did not have a very good upbringing. And there was an accident where his battle buddy, his partner in the war, was killed accidentally, and Don was injured. At the time, Don's name was Dick Richard, and his buddy's name was Don Draper. And Dick had the idea that I can take this guy's identity. They messed up medical records in the hospital. They thought he, Dick, was Don Draper, and he thought, I could run with this. I could start a new life. I don't want to be Dick from the farm anymore. I'm going to be Don Draper. So he assumes this identity, changes all his legal stuff, goes on and builds this amazing life on the surface. But sooner or later, it catches up to him. And he gets married to a lovely woman on the surface. But Don has a pattern of cheating. He cheats on his wife. He cuts quarters with his business ethics, and it catches up, and it catches up, and eventually his wife, Betty, finds this box that contains pictures and letters from his old family life and says, hey, what's in the box? They have a conversation, and there's two phrases Don uses when he's finally found out. Betty says, why didn't you tell me? Why couldn't you just tell me when we were dating this story? I love you for who you are. Why couldn't you just tell me? And these are the two phrases. Don Draper, why he had to hide his identity, cover up his past. I didn't think I had a choice. I couldn't risk all this. All this being the big house and the facade and the popularity and the finances. I couldn't risk all this. If I told the truth about myself, I would lose everything, and you wouldn't love me anymore. I think that's what Peter and Judas are wrestling with after they betrayed Jesus and go back on their promises. I think it's these kind of phrases that drove them and us to stay hidden. This is the lie that Judas bought. He didn't think he had a choice. The lie he bought was that he couldn't risk telling the truth and own up to his mistake and be received with unconditional love and forgiveness. He repented. He gave the money back. It didn't take in his eyes, and he couldn't hold out hope. In a nutshell, Don's story is about wanting to be fully known, afraid of the consequences of fully revealing himself. Don's story at this point ends tragically because him and his wife go on to part ways and the family is in shambles. Don's story does not end well at this point. Neither does Judas's, neither does Peter's. We're at the end of the book of Matthew, and we don't hear anything else about Judas or Peter. Judas hangs himself. Peter goes off weeping, sulking. And then no more mention in the book of Matthew is made about either of them. It looks like their stories end really, really poorly with no redemption. But we know Peter's hanging on. At least we know that he hasn't escaped to the degree that Judas chose to escape. We're going to see where Peter lands. And if you've been tracking with me at all so far, and something's churning in you, I want you to lock in and focus from this point on. Because as we see how Peter responds in the long run, his response is going to mean the world to the next days and weeks and months and years of your lives. Lock in. If you haven't locked in, please lock in these last few moments with me. We have to go to the book of John to see how Peter's story resolves. Don't turn there. John chapter 1 and verse 4. Early in the morning, by the way, this is after Jesus' death, crucifixion, and resurrection. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, have you any fish?" "No," they answered. He said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some." When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It is the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals, there was fish on it, and some bread. I love Peter's reaction. It's the Forrest Gump reaction, right? "Lieutenant Dan, Lieutenant Dan!" He jumps off the pier. Now, there's a much more famous Peter getting out of the boat story, right? If you haven't been around church or the Bible or something, it's a walking on water story. You've probably come across it. I actually like this Peter getting out of the boat story way better. Because Peter is wounded now. He's scarred. He's feeling the effects. We last saw him weeping at Jesus' arrest. Now he sees the one who he betrayed, and he just goes for it. He jumps out, he swims, there's breakfast. After breakfast, there's a personal conversation that takes place between Jesus and Peter. We jump to verse 17, towards the end of this conversation, where Jesus is asking Peter again about his commitment to him. In verse 17, the third time Jesus says to Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep." Then he said to him, "Follow me." Listen. Peter's last word about Jesus was one of denial. Jesus' last word to Peter is one of invitation. Hear that one again. Peter's last word about Jesus before his death is one of denial. Jesus' last word to Peter before he's ascended is one of invitation. "Follow me." The exclamation point is in the text. "Follow me." What was the biggest difference between Peter and Judas? Why could Peter hang on, hold on to hope, jump out of a boat, and have Jesus completely love him and forgive him and restore him? It's this. In a very personal way, Judas only experienced half of the Easter story. All Judas experienced was death. In a personal way, and then the death of Christ. He knew what that arrest was going to lead up to. In his betrayal of Jesus, Judas experiences a kind of death, a wound, a scar that would come to define his entire life. And it did, because how do we talk about Judas, the betrayer? So yeah, that scar defines Judas's entire legacy. He didn't hold out hope that the resurrection would follow, the resurrection of Christ and of himself. He cast judgment on himself. He said, "I'm not worth it. I screwed up. There's no quick fix. I'm out of here." Don't cast judgment on yourself. We don't know what these days were like for Peter. We don't know how close he was to that edge that Judas crossed over. Might have been close, might have been far. He might have been with the disciples, hanging out with them, and they're trying to comfort him. He might have been off alone in a cave, sulking and sulking, wondering how he could have betrayed his Lord and his friend like he did. We don't know, but I think some of these phrases were running through his head. I can't risk this. I can't do it. I think Peter had some Don Draper phrases running through his head. He held out hope. That's the difference. When you're in church, which you are, we're here together, hope is always present. So wherever you are, one way or another, you have held out hope. You're here. Something good is coming. You're going to have an opportunity to respond. You haven't taken the easy way out. Yeah, there's scars. Yeah, you've taken shortcuts over and over and over again. But you're here. So there's hope. And Jesus doesn't cast judgment. Peter gets a follow me with his scars. Today's a day of response because it's Communion Sunday, right? We respond together. We come to the table, the same table. We bear scars together. We don't look at each other and say, you shouldn't be up here, you shouldn't be up here. Nope, we have to be up here together because we're in the same position. Before we all come together and respond as a family, I want to speak to those of you who haven't heard this kind of thing before. You're new to exploring faith in God in church, or you're re-exploring church and God and faith, trying to figure out once and for all whether this is for you or not for you. I'm telling you today, the God we worship is a God of hope and forgiveness and complete restoration. Don't cast judgment on yourself. Don't escape, because the resurrected Christ, the Christ that Peter embraces after his betrayal, bears scars. Every picture of the resurrected Christ that we have, he has scars, holes, wounds in his hand and his feet and his side. So when Peter's scars and his shame meet with Christ's scars and his shame in an embrace, restoration is happening. New life is found, and the course of Peter's life is altered forever. The rest of his life on earth and his eternity. Scars matter. You come to Jesus with yours, and he says, I know. I've been there. In fact, I went there for you, for those scars. Scars are a death. When I was a kid and I made this bad decision, it was a kind of death because I wasn't the great friend everybody thought I was. When I experienced the loss of my father, because how he cheated himself, cheated me, that was a death to lots of hopes and dreams and how I was going to be formed as an adult. But death is only half of the Easter story. If you're here today and you're churning on the inside and you know you've experienced death, you know you've experienced this first half of the Easter story, and you've been wondering when the second half is going to come, let it come today. It's time to embrace the best part of this story, of the reason you're in a church. It's resurrection. It's where Christ's scars and your scars meet once and for all, and he sets you on a path of restoration. We're all going to respond together. We're all going to stand together in a moment. We're going to worship and we're going to take communion together. But if you're one that God is talking to and say it's time to embrace those scars, not letting them limit you anymore, and embrace new life, this is your Peter moment. Don't escape. I want all the Peters to stand right now. If you're ready to embrace this life, a new life with Christ, scars and all, I want you to stand over the next 15 seconds. I especially want you to stand because there are next steps today that we're going to instruct you about, and we're going to do it together. Don't escape. Family, let's all stand together. If I have Pastor Jeff and the elders to the front and our prayer people to the front. I want to say thank you to those of you who had the courage to stand. Those of you who just stood a second ago, here's your instructions. You're going to come to the table together. We do communion as a family. So you come up in line, we take communion in groups. You grab each other, you hold each other, and you come up here together. Those of you who stood, you're a part of this. You get to be a part of this. Embrace this. You come to the table. It's yours to embrace. And then we have prayer people over on the side. Mike and Mary Alice, Donna and Ben. After you receive communion, I want you to go see them. And they're going to talk you through and pray you through your next steps of a new life with Christ. We're going to worship. Let me give thanks for our celebration together. Would you pray with me? Jesus, it feels so amazing to tell the truth about you. To be able to declare without reservation that you are the God of love and healing and forgiveness and restoration. And there's no pretense, there's no hitches, there's no what ifs. We could bring it all to you. And you love us and you embrace us. And even with our scars, they meet your scars and you tell us, follow me. I want you. So Jesus, now we celebrate the bread and the cup together, symbolizing your body, your blood, your death and resurrection that paid for the sins of the world. Jesus, we thank you for those who've embraced your life today. Give them the right next steps. We embrace them as family. We want them to do the same for us. We love you together in your name. Amen.